Broadcasting the information the mainstream media won't touch. This is the Richie Allen Show.
My next guest is no stranger to you, and I first began speaking with him on the radio in Spain about 7 years ago, 8 years ago even. I rate him very highly. He presents a terrific program for BCFM. He presents their weekly politics program. He's a former BBC journalist. When we first spoke all those years ago, it was about the Bilderberg Group, and he's an expert on Bilderberg, and he's got plenty of opinion on lots more besides. Check out his website, bilderberg.org. Always good to welcome back to the show our own Tony Gosling. Welcome back, mate. How are you?
Hi, Richie. Yeah, fine.
Busy, also, I would say.
I mean, I run a forum too called the 9/11 Forum. Amazing that we just had in the last day or so the Saudis having a bit of a battle with the Americans and saying, hey, the Americans blew up the World Trade Center to start the war on terrorism. So, you know, slowly but surely, this stuff is coming out, isn't it?
It's coming out, Tony. It is. It's becoming more and more difficult for those behind it to keep it hidden from people. And that's in no small part to many of the activists who come on this programme and who you interview, and, you know, your own work as well. It's in no small part, especially the more professional, I call content creators, who presented well and presented in a credible way. And you've been doing that for many, many years.
Well, I think the thing is that the powers that be are always trying to muddy the waters. Also, I think there's also nutter magnets out there. So all I'm saying is people who may have quite a lot of a reasonably high profile, that is to say some money to spend to market their alternative news, in inverted commas, but it's kind of poisoned with a lot of disinformation. I mean, what I do try and do, Richie, is really stick with the stuff which we can back up one way or another. And I mean, that doesn't mean to say, I mean, for example, I will talk about the Illuminati quite happily with people, but I'll talk about an organization which is historically proven to existed in the late 1700s, not necessarily the Bilderbergers. Do you know what I mean?
So yes,
the idea is to contextualize this. You know, what do we really know? Fine to speculate, but don't mix fact and speculation.
Oh, it's brilliant. I've been speaking quite a bit in the last couple of weeks about the pharmaceutical cartel, IG Farben and Hoechst and BASF. Now, it's really interesting to be talking to you tonight because obviously Bayer want to buy Monsanto. Now, you've been speaking to me for years about Bayer and the part they played in supporting Hitler and their, you know, their ultimate vision of a post-World War II Europe with Hitler in charge so that they could have all the spoils of war, all the wealth and all of that. And it's really timely to talk about that and the Bilderbergs. And this EU referendum, Tony, in a month's time, we're reporting on it every single day. You're reporting on it on your programmes as well. Where do you think, I mean, I'm obviously campaigning, well, campaigning is a strong word. I'm explaining nightly to my listeners why I would vote to leave the European Union, and I would continue to do that. Where do you think the British public are in terms of the information they're getting from the media, who they're listening to, and how they might vote in a month's time? Where are you seeing all of this?
Well, look, we're looking at a situation very similar to last year's general election, where it was supposed to be very, very close. Well, I think this is at the moment very, very close. But the thing is that there's trickery going on behind the scenes. There's propaganda, particularly the media being used, the mainstream press and the London media being used. I don't know. I mean, last Tuesday evening, the ITV Evening News, we had a very pro state remain in the EU piece. Being put out by ITN on Channel 3, whatever it is, about 6:30, I think their news is, their national news. And that was lasted for 3 or 4 minutes. Then there was let's take a look at what the Brexit camp have got to say about this. And you know what? The screen just went blank. There was a blank screen on the news for 3 or 4 seconds, and all of a sudden there was a sort of shuffling of papers and they were back to the studio. Oh, it looks as if we don't have time for that full report there, you know. So this is the kind of thing we're starting to see. It's actually very rare that it's so absolutely blatant, and I was really gutted that I didn't get a chance to record it and stick it up onto YouTube, because I'm sure it would have been an absolute sensation if someone had uploaded it. But then after the break on this news bulletin last week, then there was another piece which was pro remain in the EU, but Farage never got a look in, or anybody from the Brexit camp. It totally biased. And you know what? I wonder if maybe this might work in the favour of the Brexiters, because it's becoming rather obvious that that big media wants us to stay in the EU for all sorts of reasons. And of course, because the EU is run by big corporations, and many and much of this media, particularly the Murdoch empire, they're big corporations. They want us to remain in the European Union.
Your comments were echoed by Neil Hamilton on this programme last night, particularly about the BBC. I think he's been particularly horrified by the conduct of the BBC in the overall debate, but he shouldn't be. I mean, he should know better, and he should know where the BBC gets its funding from, and he shouldn't be surprised by that at all.
Well, it gets its money from us, but you know, there is at least, I think, for example, in programmes like Question Time, you're getting quite a good spread of opinion. But you'll get, I think, a lot more of this as it all comes a little bit closer. I can't call this one, Richie. I really can't, even though it's the most momentous bit of democracy that we've had in Britain for the last 40 years. It's really difficult to know which way. I mean, I had a chap called Dave Barmby on my program. He's a former he's an electronics engineer from Marconi when Marconi existed, and he's a UKIPper. And he was explaining how the actual voting on the 23rd of June is very much suspect, that they're not going to be announcing local amounts in the votes, that they're all going to be pooled in these giant regional voting centres, and we're only going to know what a whole region of the country voted. For example, here in Bristol, it'd be very interesting to know, you know, what the demographic was. Of course, in an ordinary local election or general election, you have a very, very good idea which way people are voting and which cities are very pro-Brexit, the countryside maybe being anti or whatever. And we're going to get none of that, it seems, this time.
So your guess then, Tony, basically is terrified of fraud. We're looking at fraud here.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what happened. If you're not – okay, so you're counting the votes, but you're not going to announce and allow anyone in that area to know what the result was. You're going to take those votes to a regional centre, pull all the answers, and you're going to announce it there, the totals of all of the local counts. So I'm not quite sure whether they're going to put a legal challenge together to try and make sure that we all know afterwards who voted which way. But I hope they do, because something similar happened, apparently. I didn't realise this, back in 1975 when we had the vote to join the EEC. You know, there was quite a lot of bamboozling going on at that referendum. But ultimately, I would like to think that Britain will vote for Brexit, because I think that there is that kind of independent-minded spirit that does understand that there is no democracy whatever in Brussels, and that if... for example, people my age who can remember the country back in 1973 when we joined the EEC, of course...
You're not that old, Tony, are you?
Yes, of course I am.
I'm 41. I've got to ask you, I wouldn't ask you, complete sexist, I wouldn't ask a lady this. How old are you then?
53.
Jesus Christ. Well, so you are then, yeah, you're...
Yeah, I can remember it very well.
You've got a very youthful countenance,
and
my apologies.
I remember at the time thinking, this is no good. I didn't have a vote at the time. I think I was too young. But, you know, anyone that can remember Britain back then, okay, so there were problems with trade unions and things like that in the 1970s. Of course, that was good, because trade unions are generally quite good. They're very much more democratic than our political parties, by the way, and many more members, something like 20, 30 times more people, members, maybe even more than that these days, of trade unions than of political parties. But look, the fact of the matter was, we had industry in Britain, we had manufacturing industries right across the country. Nowadays, zero.
There's nothing.
Basically nothing. And you've got what you've got. I mean, I've been out in the country today, had a bit of a day off, and you go around the countryside and you think, well, what are these people doing? Most of them seem to be sort of just, they've managed to afford to buy a house, and if they haven't, then they're working like crazy people, trying desperately to pay the rent or pay the mortgage. And we've got two classes in this country. People who are seem to have managed to buy their home. They maybe have got stocks and shares in electricity companies, things like that. So they're paying very, very little for their utility bills. And, you know, they're getting interest from stocks and shares, which is where this QE money is all going into, you know, the stock market and into the asset bubble, the property bubble that's been created. But in reality, I don't think we've got really anything much to, you know, we to create, or there's very little success in the economy. If you look at the growth figures that the government, and by the way, I just heard on the way up here that the growth figures are bad, and that George Osborne has had to borrow, is it 7 billion extra this month, you know, because the economy is not working.
And in the same day, my friend, in the same day this is announced, RT had a terrific report about the failure of George Osborne in getting a good deal for the taxpayer when he has privatised British state assets.
Yeah, but he's only interested in getting a good deal for the City of London. Well,
for his friends, of course he is.
Yeah, for his mates.
But it's ironic, on the same day you're talking about, oh, there's a £7 billion shortfall, we need this, we need that, and you've sold off the stake in Eurostar, you've sold off Royal Mail. I mean, the Eurostar one is particularly criminal because he was told by everybody, everyone who he consulted said, don't sell off Eurostar because new routes opening in Europe in the next 10 years are going to make the public stake, which is 40% in Eurostar, absolutely astronomical in terms of the money it's worth. And the criminal bastard sold it anyway for 757 million quid, which is nothing. Nothing in the grand scheme of things.
The only growth we're getting is really, because it is included in the growth figures, is through asset inflation, that is to say house prices going up. So when there are transactions, house transactions look bigger. That's the only reason we've got. Otherwise, we'd be in negative growth. So this is a completely fake recovery. There is no recovery. We're still in a deep recession. Actually, there's a very good economist, if anyone's into this sort of thing, to look up, Anastasia Nesvratilova. I think she's at, one of the, I can't remember the which one it is, but one of the big Birkbeck College, I think it is, in London, or I think it's now called Birkbeck University. And she's basically saying there's been absolutely no recovery. Yeah, this idea that there is any kind of, is just complete and utter fiction, promulgated by a bunch. Well, actually, not that many, a handful of financial journalists in London who are all in the pockets of the city, and we're not getting any kind of real critique of what's going on economically, which is basically a disaster that Osborne has. And we're on this kind of cliff edge where any time this bubble can just go bang, because the it's only the QE that's keeping things going.
We must mention, by the way, Tony's talking about quantitative easing, which is basically the printing of money by the Treasury. Money's at, they tell you it's going to trickle down, it's going to re-stimulate the economy, but as Tony said, it doesn't. It does far from it. Funny you say about The Economist, Tony. I will say this, I played a clip from, in the monologue earlier on, I played a clip from Jonathan Portes, former Treasury economist, speaking to ITV News yesterday, and he annihilated the fact that the government is playing loose with the facts, the warnings about house prices dropping, unemployment rising, if Britain were to leave the European Union, he basically demolished them. But I want to take you up on something you said earlier on, because you said that from what you've seen of Question Time, you think there's been a fair, it's been fair in terms of sharing out the allotted slots to in campaigners and Remain campaigners. No, you mightn't have. I wasn't going to criticize you.
You're getting from the audience. You're getting
From the audience, right?
Better spread of opinion, particularly on Brexit, than you've been getting from the panels. What they do is they tend to get the panels which are. I mean, if you think about it, you've got a widespread of opinion here. What you tend to get is the pigeonhole idea of the Brexiter as a anti-regulation Tory who just sees the Brussels as doing all these extra regulations. We don't want that. So you're getting a kind of right-wing Brexit, but you're not getting much of the left-wing Brexit. The problem with the right-wing Brexit, of course, is that it's actually lack of regulation in finance that's brought us where we are today. So we, and you know, in many ways, this is a kind of a psychological trick they're playing. Oh no, we've got to get rid of the regulations. No, we just need regulations that work for the people.
Spot on.
Rather than spot on.
These free market these free market capitalists are absolute lunatics. I mean, and it's very unfair of me to say that, because Jeff Berwick, who's been on the program a couple of times, Jeff's a nice guy, but I think his whole idea that regulation gets in the way and that the markets and, you know, companies will eventually take us out of the shit, it's absolutely crazy. What I was going to say about the BBC is, I was going to go back to Ken Livingstone's comments about Zionism and Hitler and the deal that was made in 1933 and all of that. I believe, Tony, the reason there was such a furore over that, and the reason why Livingston has been hammered for saying it, and the reason why the Labour Party are being accused of anti-Semitism, is because the cabal that wants to centralise power and wants to basically completely, you know, destroy any notion of sovereignty, they are terrified that people find out who was really behind the First and Second World Wars and how both of those wars were an attempt to unite the continent under the rule of one. And that's what they don't want anybody talking about that.
With respect, I don't think it's got anything to do with that. I think it's
It's got a lot, Tony.
I think it's Linton Crosby, the advisor to the Tory party. I think that they've used this sort of tactic in the United States successfully because there's a very large number of Christian Zionists in America. I mean, basically, there are a lot of Christians in the States will believe that somehow Netanyahu is there, put there by God, you know, some kind of prophet or whatever, doing exactly what God wants him to do. And there's a lot more people in the US that believe that Christian Zionist nonsense. Well, actually, it's a heresy if you want to look at it like that.
Yeah.
Crosby has used that sort of tactic successfully and seen it used in the US, and they tried to use it in the run-up to the London mayor election specifically so that they could target the left wing of the Labour Party and specifically Sadiq Khan because of him being a Muslim. They were trying also to attach him to apparently he'd shared a platform with a guy who they called the mastermind of the London bombings, who actually I think probably works at MI5 somewhere and or maybe at Mossad, and is certainly not who they said he was. But that I think was what was going on there. It was a specifically taken from a US style election tactics, and they tried to use it in London. The only thing is it actually did not work at all. In fact, it worked in the opposite direction. I think it's quite feasible that more people voted for Sadiq Khan because they were so disgusted with the way that the London media were churning this stuff out uncritically. One thing to say about that is that the way that John Mann basically almost mugged Ken Livingstone outside the BBC at Millbank was quite obviously a setup of some kind where, I mean, how did he know Ken
Livingstone? Well, they phoned the media as well.
Turn up. Yeah. What was the BBC camera crew doing just hanging around on the pavement outside? You know, what a happy coincidence. So that Livingstone was definitely mugged there by, you know, somebody, not necessarily by the BBC. See, he may have been Mann saying, come outside, I'm going to do something in a minute. You know, certainly John Mann was involved in that. But I don't know. I mean, the there is a real understanding of what you were saying about First World War, Second World War and all that kind of thing. I don't think it's that complex. I think it's much more to do with specifically aimed at that London election. But anyway, you know, you may have a different view. I'm sure you do.
Yeah, I do, because you and I both know why World War One happened, why the Second World War was started, who funded them. We know that at the same time, we know through through the courage of Smedley Butler that they tried to get rid of FDR in Washington DC, the same cabal. And I'm not saying you're wrong in your analysis of that situation. Again, you might well be right. It's not the Mutual Appreciation Society here, folks, but you know, I do respect Tony's opinion. But Tony, the world at large doesn't know this. They don't know why the European Union was mooted, first of all, why it was planned and who planned it, and what it's ultimately meant to do, which is ultimately meant to bring about the, you know, this leg, for want of a better word, this leg of the final move towards a one world government run by corporations.
But look,
we know that, right? The people don't know that.
Though, Livingstone was talking about this 1933 transfer agreement between the Hitler's Nazi party, who'd recently come to power, and the Zionists. Now, the thing to understand about that...
You're right, and I'm not... Can I just say, I'm not missing that point. You are absolutely right. The point I was trying to make was, I'm not saying that Livingstone was talking about the European Union there. He wasn't at all. What I'm saying is, if people, Tony, uneducated people, most of us are uneducated until we educate ourselves, if they start looking at what Livingstone was saying about who Hitler was, who the Nazi party were, and start to look behind them, who was behind them, who funded them, who enabled them, then they start to find names like Bass and Hoekst and Boyer. That's the point I was making. No, and okay, the cabal can never have that.
But I mean, you know, this is a really important bit of history, which very few people know about, is that that there was an international Jewish boycott going on, that the Zionists broke the boycott. And this is really important for people to understand that, you know, there is a complex thing going on here where most Jews around the world at the time were absolutely horrified that these Zionists had basically stabbed them in the back. And that's what Ken was kind of hinting at when he started going into this. But I mean, this is sort of propaganda. We're used to it. We do other things on programs like this. I wonder how what your feeling is, Richie, about the censorship around this super injunction. Because I'm really concerned that these
These
super injunctions are starting to be used where there's actually a massively important story with a big public interest. Some judge comes along and says, there's no public interest here. You're not allowed to report
it. Set the scene, because we, like you, my friend, we have listeners all over the shop, listeners listening in different countries. Give us, remind our listeners what this is about. There's one particular story, and you can name Elton John if you want. I don't mind. And David Furnish. I have no problem with that. I'd love to. Do you know what it is, Tony? We're starved for attention. The independent media. We could do with a bit of. Judicial interference.
Another lawsuit.
I could do with that. I could do with a kick in the arse. Yeah, but
the fact of the matter is, judges are really not in the best people to decide what's in the public interest.
No, of course not.
What isn't? The journalists are generally fairly good at it, and in fact, it's what makes them good at their job or makes them better than another person. Although, of course, when it comes to the tabloid press, I mean, that's total rubbish, because a lot of it is just salacious nonsense. But when it comes to this particular story about Elton John and David Furnish, I'm glad you named them before I did. But for example, you've got a whole backstory as to why it might not be appropriate for them to have sex in an olive-filled paddling pool after having a threesome, because there's this whole issue of John and Furnish adopting these children who were born by a surrogate mother. I think it's Zachary, who's 5 years old, and Elijah, who's 3 years old. And I'm not saying they were there at the time, but is this the appropriate kind of behavior for a mother and father, as they call themselves? Because actually, David Furnish has been named as the mother of these adopted children.
I'm going to argue with you now, my friend. I love you to bits, but I'm going to argue with you. If those children were being taken care of by a babysitter, which I'm sure they were, what Elton John and David Furnish get up to in their bed or anybody else's bed, it has got no bearing on their ability to raise a child, I would say.
Well, there are maybe that's the judge's opinion.
Yeah,
but I think it's.
But I still agree with you.
There's a much wider debate here.
I agree with you
about that sort of adoption and whether this is appropriate. I mean, I have very little respect for Elton John as anyone with much talent at all. I mean, when I was at school, I mean, we knew Elton John just sings other people's songs. He doesn't write his own songs. I mean, songs like Daniel, Crocodile Rock, Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, Rocket Man, Sorry Seems to Be the Hardest Word, Your Song, Sad Song, Say So Much. He didn't write any of those songs. They were written by Bernie Taupin.
He's guilty. Lock him up.
Yeah, he's
guilty. Lock him up. Tony, I tell you what, you're right about the super injunctions. And my close friend and colleague, David Icke, and other colleagues of mine would agree with you 100% here. Because what this is about is not protecting the or protecting Elton John and Furnish or anybody else from embarrassment. It's about something more sinister. It's about conditioning the public to it, I believe. Is it in the public interest? It is in the public interest when they start serving injunctions like that. That's when it's in the public interest. Is what Elton John does in his bedroom or his partner in the public interest? I don't know about that. And I'm glad you talked about salacious stories. This is the sort of shit that the tabloids do when they should be investigating the sorts of people that you investigate.
But, there is
all that sort of stuff, right?
Debate about
same-sex adoption and that sort of thing.
Adoption by gay couples. I mean, I think it's, oh gosh, what's her name? Certainly Dolce and Gabbana, who these two fashion designers talked about these being synthetic children. And, you know, this is actually, you know, I'm not saying I think they are synthetic children. I'm saying that this kind of thing, it's the sort of, and Jermaine Greer weighed in as well, didn't she? She weighed in over saying, look, this is IVF. This is wrong for them to be doing this. and particularly saying, naming David Furnish as the mother of these children.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, there is a debate to be had, and Elton John doesn't want that debate. If you go and put Elton John into Google, you'll find absolutely none of this. He's
none
managed
of it.
To get it out completely off.
Well, I'll say this, Tony,
and I'm not defending John.
There's
a whole load of wonderful things. Elton John's done this, isn't it wonderful?
There's
a whole list of 30 or 40 stories about what a great guy, how fantastic he is, basically just promoting him as a celebrity. Now, there are questions about
that's wrong, right? That
should be discussed, and this is completely legitimate as a journalistic endeavor. And I think this is they're trying to use this as a kind of Trojan horse to drive a wedge in between the courts and the newspapers to stop them reporting things they don't want, and also to get it completely removed from the internet. I mean, I got an email from Twitter this morning saying you've got to take this tweet down, you know, and it irks me.
It was about
stuff that's going on in other parts of the world.
And it was about this. Let me just jump in there, because one of the things that pisses me off is you're quite right to talk about the lack of any talk about this. Now, so John and Furnish, they have this baby with this woman in the manner that you described. There isn't any talk about it in the media, and it's applauded and it's congratulated. Now, I'm not being the devil's advocate here. I'm going to be honest. I despise people like Elton John as well and the way they behave. However, the lack of any comment on it in the media is not so much down to John and Furnish and other same-sex adopters. It's more down to this ludicrous, the rise of this political correctness, Tony, in society. We're seeing it now around the debate about transgender men and women and which toilets they can use and stuff like that. You know, if you have an opinion on it that doesn't suit the politically correct establishment, well, you're hammered for it, you're cold, you know, they say that you've got prejudices, you're hateful, all of this bollocks. It's not true. So John, while we might have misgivings about what he does and how he does it, there's a lack of reporting on whether it's right or wrong, him and furnishing the child. I don't believe it's his fault. The super injunction, certainly, any sexual dalliances, definitely. But the non-reporting on whether or not they should have that baby, that's an establishment thing. I don't believe that's down to John and his partner. What do you say to that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think you're probably right. But, I mean, the other thing is, of course, this celebrity stuff, it is kind of designed to distract us from the things that really matter about
obviously
the future, you know, like the Bilderberg conference. And we've got, steering things around to thinking about that again. I mean, because I don't want to go on about this too much, and I don't think we probably don't disagree very much at all.
No.
Only in that the super injunction, this is an important, you know, stage test for it to see, well, we can do this and it's all politically correct, and we must make sure that people do as we wish them to, and poor old Elton, you know, we mustn't be prejudiced against him. But of course, this is a Trojan horse for much, much more restrictions of reporting of privacy. Now, you know, the courts, I don't think, are really the right place to do that. And also, you've got one of the other things that I've noticed over years of doing journalism is you tend to get some hideous stuff, really appalling stuff, written about poor people on council estates, maybe fat people, you know, this kind of thing. And there's loads of it. The Daily Mail's full of it, you know, week after week. Bad, bad reporting, really disgusting. And it's only because these people have got no money and they can't go to the High Court and they can't sue the newspapers. The people who do this all the time are the rich and powerful. And that really irks me. We're in a situation now where it's very difficult for anybody to actually get justice. I mean, good God, the poor Hillsborough people found this out, didn't they? And all grieving people like this, unless you've got wads of cash to pay the lawyers. And Ken Clark, the Bilderberg representative for Britain for many years on the steering committee, he was the guy who back in 2010 started the process of just basically smashing the legal aid system, so that for many, many different forms of court cases now, including things like employment tribunals, all this sort of thing, there's actually no defence whatsoever for somebody. If they've got no money, then they just simply have to try and go into the court and prepare all the papers themselves. They get no proper legal advice, no free legal advice. So we've got courts that are only working for the rich in Britain now, and that is just the most hideous state of affairs. And I suppose that's why I'm so irked about this super injunction, because to me that is just right. We don't want you to write about that. What's happening is political parties, specific individuals, rich people, rich companies, celebrities are basically running a brand. And if anyone starts criticising that brand, that person is going to get slammed, whether it's the Daily Mail or whoever, because these super injunctions can be really pervasive right across the internet, for example. So people in other parts of the world are reading about this, but we're not allowed to, apparently.
Right. I'm going to read a few tweets, my friend. I'm going to read them really quickly, and then we'll move on then. La Antenna on Twitter says, yes, Tony Gosling, yes, perfect terms, left-wing Brexit and right-wing Brexit. Left-wing must not fear association with the right, says La Antenna. Martin Houston tweets, what the hell was John Mann doing? He's on self-destruct for his reputation over the whole anti-Semitic bullshit. Jane tweets, Heath took us into the European Union unconstitutionally, and the vote after was, do you wish to remain in the EU? So it's all void. Well, Ted Heath even was probably compromised, Jane, at least I believe he was. Nick Parkin says, the crimes and punishment of IG Farben make a good paperweight for the average Joe, but sadly, that is all. David says, as in the words, David Stanford, in the words of the great man Jordan Maxwell, people need to do their homework. JP was on to say, super injunctions for the rich. Can't see Big D from Benefit Street getting one. That's an interesting one. Corporations and the press use them mostly. Alex says, you've had guests on your show who've lost their kids for less than accusations of what they get up to behind closed doors. Alex is referring to allegations about Furnish and Elton John. And that is right. We have had people on this program who've lost their children for absolutely ridiculous reasons as well. Keep the tweets coming in. It's at Richie Allen Show. Richie at richieallen.co.uk. Martin was on to say, I think that same-sex adoption is questionable from the point of view of what's best for the child, male, female energy, says Martin. I'm not going to sit in the fence on this because I'm not one of those presenters. I don't, I'm not trying to curry favour with people. I used to be very anti same-sex adoption, and I used to say it all the time on radio that I didn't think that two men or two women is a great idea for a child. These days, I just don't know. I don't know how I feel about it.
But the point of it is, surely, Richie, is that there's a big debate to be had.
There should be a debate, Tony. You're right.
And that is not happening.
No, because the media won't allow it.
We're being told that this is, we're being given this kind of morality, a kind of fake morality, I think, anyway, where we're being told this is right. Anyone that criticises it is wrong. And because the courts have decided, you know, I think that's quite a dangerous road to go down.
Now, we're going to spend some time because it's 19 minutes, or no, it's not. It's 21 minutes to the top of the hour. We've got about 15 minutes left, you and I. Time flies. We are going to talk about Bilderberg. I've not been speaking about Bilderberg for quite a while. If you want to find out everything there is to know about Bilderberg, folks, go to bilderberg.org. It's one of Tony's websites and forums. Terrific resource for information on Bilderberg. As I said, it's not been talked about for a while on the programme. Where are they this year, Tony, and when? Remind us.
Well, there was something, I think it was about a month ago, maybe 6 weeks ago, it released in German newspaper that it's going to be in Dresden, which is in the old East Germany this year. The dates are, I think it's the 9th to the 12th of June. Some really extraordinary developments as well, because the German left party, I think they're called the Linke Party in Germany, put in some sort of Bundestag question about who's going to Bilderberg, and it got an absolutely extraordinary result, which was that the top six ministers of Merkel's government are all going. They've got a coalition government over there, which means this has never happened at a Bilderberg conference, so far as we know, before, ever, unless it's just that German freedom of information is turning up some really interesting stuff that we'd never known before. So we're talking about Angela Merkel going, we're talking about her vice chancellor. She's got some kind of like minister without portfolio, who I imagine is to do with things like the secret services, special forces, things like that. She's got the defense minister, the foreign minister, and the their equivalent of the chancellor of the exchequer, treasury minister, finance minister, you know. So there's six top. This is the apex of the German government all going to this particular Bilderberg conference. Now, in the past, for people that don't, I mean, obviously, most of your listeners will be familiar with the Bilderberg as a kind of cabal, apex of the Western elite. But most of these conferences in the past, for all the ones I've seen, you rarely get the actual sitting prime minister of the country going at all. What you will often get is somebody who's, for example, an up-and-coming or maybe leader of the opposition or an upcoming opposition politician going along, and you've got a handful of politicians from the host country, maybe three or four at the most. And so to have the top six serving government officials going to a non-political casual meeting is just unbelievable. I was really shocked to see this list of people who are going. I mean, this is the real heavyweights in German politics. And also worth mentioning is last year the conference took place in Austria, in Tyrol, which incidentally was one of the hot places for the Nazis to escape in 1945, at the end of the Second World War. One of the rat lines ran through Tyrol. A lot of them lived there, stayed there undercover at the end of the war. And then before that, we had Denmark. So what's happening is it seems to be sort of spiraling in towards Germany, Richie. I don't know, over the last few years.
How interesting that
closer
is.
Closer and closer to Germany. And you know, the research I've done over the years, and it's a shame that this is not in anywhere, really, in the Daniel Estulin book on the Bilderberg, Club Bilderberg, is that the roots of the Bilderberg is most definitely in the collaboration between the Americans, the Brits, and the Nazis at the end of the Second World War. The Battle of Arnhem, the Market Garden, the liberation of Holland took place in September 1944. At least it was planned to liberate Holland, but there was treachery involved there, and many people died, particularly in Arnhem in the 1st Airborne Division. And the whole story is told very well in Joseph E. Levine's film, A Bridge Too Far. Now, tens of thousands of British were killed at the 1st Airborne Division because there was no rescue of them, even though it looked like there could have been and there should have been. If you go back through the historical records, Lord Carrington was sitting in a tank of the Grenadier Guards at Nijmegen, and he could have just driven down the road and helped to rescue these poor guys. But he didn't. And what happened was the 1st Airborne got surrounded at Oosterbeek, which is a suburb of Arnhem, and massacred over 3 or 4 days in something called the Witch's Cauldron, they called it, because they were completely surrounded by heavily armed and armoured German units. And basically it was a massacre of the British 1st Airborne Division. Now, that exact same spot is where the very first Bilderberg meeting took place 10 years after the battle. The Bilderberg Hotel is in that perimeter where that battle took place. And I think, you know, it's a kind of an in-joke. It's a bit of a sick one, isn't it? But an in-joke that the Bilderbergs used that, because it was definitely treachery. There was spy. Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, a former Nazi, was over in Britain. He knew the details of the plan. He sent some guy in called Christian Lindemans, who was the traitor of Arnhem that betrayed the whole operation to the Germans a couple of days before it actually took place. And, you know, it seems that attempt to stop that operation was very significant in that it extended the time of the war took place. I mean, basically, if that operation had been successful, they would have been really, the war would have been finished by Christmas time, because it was a very well aimed punch towards the Ruhr, which was the German manufacturing heartland. And because they didn't cross the Rhine successfully, get a bridgehead there, it meant that the war was able to carry on. Now, that gave the Nazis another 4 or 5 months to squirrel away their gold, the wealth, the looted millions from billions, actually, from all over Europe, so that they could cash it in after the war, which they most definitely did.
We were getting questions from listeners based around something Tony the lunatic Blair has been saying in recent days about we need a ground war in Syria. There's not enough blood for the likes of Blair. But is it safe to assume that what might be on the Bilderberg agenda, and by the way, just in case, because of where we go out, there very well may be people listening to the program who maybe don't know about Bilderberg. Tony could sum it up. I'll sum it up in a couple of lines for you. It's an annual meeting of the captains of industry and political heavyweights sometimes, or political people on the rise. 3 days, once a year.
Bankers
as well, of course.
And royalty.
Bankers and royalty. And they meet for three 3 days, and they claim that what they're doing is it's basically a social meeting for people to get together and talk about things without the glare of the media spotlight. But it's utter nonsense because, you know, there's no reporting on the meeting. There are no minutes kept, or there are minutes kept, but they're not made available to the public anyway. It's as sinister as it gets. A couple of years ago, Michael Meacher asked a question of Ken Clark at Westminster about it, a really good question about, you know, the legitimacy of it and the legality of it, and Clark just laughed at him. So, Tony, what can we expect? Do we expect that the Syria and Russia and China are going to be on the agenda this time around?
Well, look, first of all, also to add to your very good description there, the Bilderberg meetings were chaired for the first 20 years by Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, who at the time, very few people realised that he was a former SS officer, that he was in the Nazi party, although he tried to deny it right at the very beginning of the Nazi era. He was a German aristocrat. This aspect of it hasn't really, you know, I think this is, to me, this was the thing that really piqued my interest with this group. You know, how on earth can you say you're a former Nazi chairing a meeting for 20 years, not just a Nazi, an officer in the SS who joined in the very early stages, so he was obviously a big enthusiast for it, and then he so-called switched sides just before the war started. You know, this is really, I think the Dutch understand this very well. It's a very, very, there's a guy called Philip Droog, who I've interviewed. He's the chair of the Dutch Freelance Journalists Association, and he's written a really good book on Bernhard. And many of the Dutch, this is normal knowledge of the Dutch, that Bernhard was working for the Nazis, but pretty much people don't realise that over here. So this was a Nazi organisation, I think it's fair to say, and the people who were invited along to the first meetings were those who'd been, they'd been successfully collaborating with during the war. So a bit like NATO, you know. In fact, Paul Hauser, who was on the Eastern Front, he was a SS Panzer Corps general during the war, and after the war, he was the chairman of the SS Veterans Association. Hauser's quite a bizarre figure, but he said the first meetings of NATO were convened with the international supporters of the SS. I mean, these are powerful things to say. Maybe, you know, he's the guy who should know about this. So, you know, you can see NATO and Bilderberg's very close. Also, generally, I won't be sure about every single Secretary General of NATO, but certainly since the mid-1970s, pretty much every NATO Secretary General has been along to the Bilderberg Conference the year before that they were became Secretary General. So it's very closely knitted into NATO, which is the main problem, of course. It's pretty much totally unaccountable. Never mind getting out of the EU.
But we can speculate. Get out of NATO, but we can speculate about what's going to be on the agenda. And listeners are asking about, you know, a serious conflict, a conflict that you might call World War III between the West and the East, Russia and China. What do you think about that when you hear that thrown around, World War III?
You could say Bilderberg has failed, can't you? Because they were very much behind the original European Economic Community and the EU. According to George McGee, who's the US ambassador to West Germany, and you know, he was absolutely adamant this is where it was formed. So you could say the whole thing is Bilderberg has been a disaster. Looking at the economic situation, looking at the migrant crisis, this is exactly the sort of thing that the EU and Bilderberg should have sorted out. Now, I would take issue with that and say, well, actually, I think crisis and chaos is what these people thrive on. They are, I think, able to go into situations like Libya, and they've created they basically denied it to other big superpowers who were interested in cooperating with Gaddafi, like the Chinese and possibly the Russians. They've denied it to them. They've created a complete chaos zone, a killing zone, and they then start, as they're now starting to do, go in to try and take control of that. So they're creating chaos, and then I think that's what they've been trying to do. But this is why the whole Brexit thing at the moment is so critical. And this Bilderberg conference is taking place just whatever it is, 2 weeks before it. I think, well, imagine what one of the things they'll be saying there is, well, we need to be prepared both for a Brexit and for if the British vote to remain. And I'd imagine they'll try and convince other countries, if Britain does decide to remain, that they can do something about these major problems that we've got in Europe, particularly the economic ones. So, I mean, that I think is going to be one of the things which is top of the agenda there, because the Americans, it was CIA money that originally funded these Bilderberg conferences. And of course, you, I'm sure many of your listeners know the connections between the CIA and the Nazis. Many of the Nazis were brought into the US because during the Cold War they were seen as really fantastic assets to fight the Soviet Union.
Paperclip, of course yeah. They were. But more than that. Tony, we're going to have to leave it for now, my friend. I want, in the last 30 seconds that we have left, I want you to give a couple of plugs to where people can find you and where they can hear your excellent programme, mate.
Well, we do a show every Friday drive time here in Bristol, so you can pick that up. The stream, I think, the best place, easiest place to find it is thisweek.org.uk, but you can find it also at bcfmradio.com. Also have a look at the discussion forum we do, which has got threads about just about everything, including mind control, God knows what, anything you want, really, including current stuff. That's 911forum.org.uk. Plus the Bilderberg.org site is really about documenting the history of the Bilderbergers over the years. I mean, I haven't updated it for a little while, but there's, you know, that this is stuff that is timeless. And I did a load of work back when I was in Oxford going through the libraries there in the mid-1990s, digging out the origins of these people and the groups. And it's quite fascinating, you know, for anyone that's really interested in looking at origins. I mean, you talked about the Nazi Party. Peter Levender's book, Unholy Alliance, goes into that. He traces it back to the Theosophists, for example. So the origins are always important with all of this stuff.
Of course.
Where does it come from? If you want to understand what it is, just have a look and take a look at who started it all up in the first place.
Tony, always a pleasure. Thanks, mate. Look after yourself and let's talk again real soon.
No, thanks very much for having me on, Richie.
Always a pleasure, mate. Tony Gosling on the line to us there from his home in Bristol.